Before you listen to this podcast, you can subscribe to The Critic magazine with the current offer of 5 issues for just £10. Head to our website, www.thecritic.co.uk, to subscribe today.
In this episode of Black's History Week, Professor Jeremy Black talks to Graham Stewart about the origins and course of the 30 Years' War in the German lands.
What was to become known as the 30 Years' War began in 1618, and I think it's fair to say that, as with most labels subsequently applied, contemporaries would have been surprised to know that that was what was going on. As we mentioned yesterday, there had already been limited conflicts in the empire in the period after the Peace of Augsburg of 1555. We mentioned in particular conflict in the Rhineland, focused on Cologne in the 1580s, and then again in the Lower Rhineland, focused on the Jülich-Kleve crisis between 1609 to 1614. And those were by no means the only conflicts in the broader geopolitical area. I mean, for example, there was fighting in northern Italy in the 1610s involving Savoy-Piedmont, involving Venice, involving the Spaniards in Lombardy, and so on and so forth. So the fact that there was going to be an overthrow of Habsburg authority in 1618 in Prague, and that in place of Ferdinand II of Styria, Steiermark, who had a reputation as a rather resolute Catholic, a stalwart of the Counter-Reformation, in place of him, the Elector Palatine, Frederick V of the Palatinate, who was a Calvinist, becomes King of Bohemia. That would not automatically necessarily have been seen as triggering a broader conflict. And indeed, as with many other wars we know about, and as you know, Graham, I've written quite extensively on the causes of war, there are moments in which you could say, in which contemporaries would have said, well, that's it, this has all been settled. Is this going to lead to anything broader? At first, it was by no means clear that Ferdinand II would be able to, in his attempt to regain what he saw as his position on the Habsburg position in Bohemia, that he would be able to call on sufficient external support to make that a big proposition. He did. The Kingdom of Bohemia, of course, was important because it was one of the seven electoral votes for the new emperor, and Ferdinand becomes the new emperor in 1619. But he is able to counterattack, as it were, because he wins the support of two of the leading German rulers. One of them is a Catholic, Duke Maximilian of Bavaria, an astute man. The other one is a Lutheran, John George I, Elector of Saxony, also interested in expanding his dominions. But what this means is you've got to be very careful to see this in simple confessional Protestant versus Catholic terms. Indeed, John George is to play his part, not only because Ferdinand offered him part of the Kingdom of Bohemia, the wider kingdom, namely the area of Lusatia, the area around Bautzen and Gurlitz, which subsequently becomes part of East Germany, but also because, like most Lutherans, he was hostile to Calvinism, and like most German princes, he was worried about violent disruption of the empire and was loyal to both the emperor and the imperial constitution. Now, this coalition of Saxony, Bavaria, the new Habsburg, backed by, of course, the other line of the Habsburgs, the Spaniards, who provide diplomatic encouragement, finance, and are able to provide in the Rhineland military pressure from their position in the Spanish Netherlands, which we would call Belgium. All of those ensure that there is really very little prospect of Frederick succeeding. Having said that, as we know from looking at the Hussite Wars in the early 15th century, you could easily have written off the Hussites and say they were bound to fail. And indeed, what is in some respects more interesting is the rapid success of the Habsburgs and their alliance. In particular, Ferdinand's army defeats Frederick's army at the Battle of the White Mountain outside Prague, one of the many decisive battles of the era. As you may know, just as an interlude, there is a historical conceit repeated endlessly by weak general historians, which argue that warfare prior to the changes brought in by the French Revolution and supposedly modern warfare, that warfare was limited, antiquated, unable to deliver results, etc., etc., etc. Complete rubbish, of course, not that it stops it being repeated. And the Battle of the White Mountain is a classic example of that. It leads to the establishment of the Habsburg position in Bohemia, a position that is to last until 1918. It has challenges to it by the Swedes at the end of the 30 Years' War, by the French and the Saxons in 1741, by the Prussians in 1744 and 1756, but essentially it holds. And it's a classic example of the ability of the warfare of that period to deliver significant results. Anyway, again, that didn't necessarily have to lead to a broader struggle in the empire, not least because the war could have been limited to the Habsburg hereditary lands, the Erblander, as they were known, because Bohemia was becoming one of the hereditary lands as a result of this, and that could have been it, and a decision could have been met that you know, this was really it. But the combination of Maximilian in particular Ferdinand takes things in a different direction, because the Spaniards and Maximilian see this as an opportunity to take the lands of the Elector Palatine. So the Spaniards in 1620 overrun the Lower Palatinate, that's the area around Heidelberg and Mannheim, helped by the ambitious Maximilian. And Maximilian has the electoral vote of the Palatinate transferred to him in 1623. So what you've actually got is in part the competition between the two branches of the Wittelsbach family, the Calvinist branch, the Elector Palatine, the Catholic branch, the Dukes of Bavaria, that plays through. And what that does is help to provoke more sustained struggle. Maximilian also has overrun the Upper Palatinate, authority over which he receives from Ferdinand. So, and Ferdinand's commitment to Maximilian helps transform the struggle, making it more clearly one involving Germany and religion, and being presentable in those eyes by Protestants who are dismayed by the loss of the Palatinate territories to Catholic rulers, and who see the danger of a very major change and transformation in the German polity. Now, I think we'll take a pause there, because obviously we can press on, but I think it's sensible to take a pause at that moment.
Yes, well, Professor Black, thank you very much indeed for that. I mean, I think at this moment, as the war is opening up and expanding, is probably just the moment for me to just ask you to set the scene of where we were just on the eve of the outbreak of what became the 30 Years' War in 1618. What was the political and religious makeup of the German lands relatively stable between Augsburg and the beginning of the 17th century? or actually was Catholicism making gains, and the coming of war was a way of the Protestant forces trying to regroup?
Well, that's an interesting point. I mean, as I mentioned last time, there was a fundamental instability to do with the position in archbishop territories, ecclesiastical territories. So I mentioned the archbishop electorate of Cologne in the 1580s. And certainly the Augsburg settlement had not really allowed for the growth of both Calvinist energy. It hadn't allowed for the degree to which, if you like, there was a Counter-Reformation energy as well. And that was very important in the case of the Archbishop Electorate of Cologne, because as I mentioned last time, the Bavarian candidate, Ernst, one of the sons of Albert V, I think it was, of Bavaria, was victorious. And so he becomes Archbishop Elector of Cologne. He goes on to become Prince Bishop of Munster as well. And what his win does is very much associate the Bavarian Wittelsbachs with the Counter-Reformation and provides the background to a Catholic revival in the Rhineland with, I think it's fair to say, proselytism matched by coercion. And the Wittelsbachs were the Bavarian Wittelsbachs, not the Palatinate ones, obviously, were archbishops of Cologne until 1761. So that increases Protestant anxiety. And there is strong anxiety in the late 16th century. But on the other hand, more positively, there is no sustained struggle comparable to what we call the French Wars of Religion, which off and on lasted from the beginning of the 1560s until 1598, nor anything equivalent to the Dutch Revolt, which again had a religious dimension and which lasts from the mid-1560s till 1609. So I think it's fair to say that, yes, you can point to many problems, but many problems don't necessarily lead to war on a certain scale.
If the Bohemians had chosen a non-Habsburg to rule over them, who was nevertheless a Catholic, would the problem have been very localized, or is really the major issue the refusal to accept the Holy Roman Empire, the imperial dominion that involved, almost regardless of religious affiliation?
Oh, well, I mean, that's a counterfactual, isn't it? and all I can do is offer suggestions. I think that it's certainly the scale and gravity and duration of what we call the 30 Years' War was not inevitable. That is, in a sense, what I'm saying. And that there were many conjunctures in which different outcomes could have arisen. How far those individual outcomes are probable is in part a question which needs to be handled with care, but which also clearly requires a lot of thought, and including an awareness of the often limited military resources of many of the players in the area, not just the German players, but the wider players. I think David Parrott's study on France, French army in the early 17th century has brought that out. Gregory Hanlon's study of the campaign of 1636 has brought that out. So I think there is a sort of slight tendency to read the 30 Years' War in the light of subsequent realist geopolitics. And I'm not sure that's always helpful. There were a whole host of reasons to believe that conflict was possible, but the conflict might be similar to the previous conflicts in Germany. And as remember, as we discussed last time, that included that between Charles V and the Schmalkaldic League in the mid-1540s. That included, again, the revival of conflict in the early 1550s, a little one in the mid-1580s, a little one again from 1609 to 1614. The reason to believe that anything inevitably will go in a certain direction is unclear, not least because if we're talking about individuals, happenstance could easily make them die.
Yes, I see. So maybe a different style of question. The tension between Calvinism and Catholicism is obvious. Were the tensions between Calvinism and Lutheranism, and beyond Bohemia, how far did Calvinism spread through Germany as distinct from Lutheranism?
Lutheranism was the dominant form. Lutheranism was the dominant form in Germany, but nevertheless, Calvinism was important in some areas. And I think what it did was create a tension within the Protestant tradition. And of course, although there is no exact parallel, you can think, for example, of the Second Civil War in Britain in 1648, in which the Scots, Presbyterians, find themselves in conflict with the English Parliamentarian Army under Oliver Cromwell, which is essentially what you might call independence. So I think one has to be cautious about assuming that the, as it were, the prime hostility was readily apparent. I would not go that far. I would say that for some Lutherans, Calvinists were a problem. For other Lutherans, it was less of a problem than they were more worried about Catholics. And certainly the growing strength and success of the Habsburgs in Germany in the 1640s, the ability to defeat in what we would call it Germany itself rather than Bohemia, not that that concept is necessarily terribly helpful for the period we're talking about, but they're able to defeat and check forces under leaders such as Christian of Brunswick, Ernst Count Mansfeld, helps to increase the anxiety of all Protestants, as does the movement north of Habsburg forces. The failure of Christian IV of Denmark when he intervenes, he's defeated at Leuthen, his army is pursued north into Jutland. And what that does is create a situation in which the forces of the Catholics, both the forces of the emperor under Wallenstein and those of the Catholic League under Count Tilly, appear to be in a position to change the dynamics of German politics.
Mm-hmm. Well, another feature which is changing the dynamic of German politics is, of course, foreign intervention, particularly the Protestants of Sweden under Gustav Adolphus, but also French intervention as well. What were the needs and motives for this intervention? And in France's case, of course, you know, it's a Catholic country. What underpins these attempts to interfere?
Right. By the way, can I just say I got Wallenstein's first name wrong? I should have said Albrecht. First of all, interfere creates the sense that there is a coherent body called Germany in which they had no role. For example, Christian IV of Denmark has territorial and jurisdictional interests in parts of the empire in the Schleswig-Holstein isthmus, as well as aspirations and interests in the ecclesiastical prince bishoprics in the northwest part of the empire. So I don't think he would have seen it as interfering, and nor would he have seen coming to the aid of co-religionists as interfering. Well, I think what one's got, and one way of looking at it, is to say that war breeds its own dynamic, that it encourages fear and anxiety about the success of other players, and that that means that people take prophylactic steps in intervening in order to stop what they think is a deteriorating situation. Now, you can put that alongside the argument that they may have particular interests, expansionist interests of their own to pursue. Certainly, I think that in the case of the late 1620s, as I've mentioned, the movement north of armies, particularly that of Wallenstein, and the interest that Ferdinand has in possibly restoring secularized church lands, all of these appear very disturbing. And you can understand why there was pressure of, by Protestant co-religionists on foreign powers to intervene. On the other hand, that wasn't strictly speaking necessary, you might argue, because the sense that Wallenstein had gone too far was expressed sufficiently strongly by German allies for Ferdinand II to actually dismiss Wallenstein in 1630 at the Diet of Regensburg. So on the one hand, you have these anxieties, and historians have made a lot about the establishment of Habsburg power on the southern shores of the Baltic, and this, as it were, motivated Sweden to need to intervene, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. On the other hand, you could say that what in fact is going on is a degree of lack of bringing to fruition of Habsburg ambitions, and a more cautious stance than might appear to be the case when adopted by alarmist commentators. You can take both points of view. And again, you mentioned the French intervening. Well, again, one's got to be cautious here. First of all, we talk about the French, but as a number of scholars have demonstrated, Joe Bergin being particularly good on this, the kind of what we might call anti-Habsburg policies associated with Cardinal Richelieu were counterpointed by those, and this is a very crude dichotomy, but it'll have to do, counterpointed by those associated with what were known as the devot or devout, a group of ministers who argued alternatively for a alignment with the Habsburgs. So there was no necessary determination. And taking it further, the initial French commitment is not in Germany, but it's in Northern Italy in the War of the Mantuan Succession from 1628 to 1631. And if anything, that, as it were, means that the French cannot intervene in Germany. They do not have the multi-purpose force that one might imagine that they had. What the French do is encourage Gustavus Adolphus of Sweden, who's been at war with Poland, a Catholic state, part of the struggle between the two branches of the Vasa family, the Swedish branch and the Polish branch, that he encourages French encourage them to end that conflict. They mediate an end to it in 1629, and they then encourage the Swedes to invade Germany, to land in Pomerania in 1630, and to begin a new stage of the war. Now, that in a way was an indirect conflict from the French point of view, And the French do not go into the war in Germany full scale until 1635. And that, you could argue, arises partly because the Swedish effort has largely failed. Gustavus Adolphus, initially victorious, particularly at Breitenfeld in 1631, defeated at Lützen. Victorious, but killed at Lützen in 1632. But the Swedes defeated at Mödlingen in 1634. That drives the Swedes out of southern Germany. And more particularly, it seems to offer the prospect of a German solution to the war, with most German princes reconciled to the Emperor, Saxony, crucially, by the Peace of Prague of 1635. And that Peace of Prague dissolves the major leagues, the Heilbronn League, the Protestant one, the Catholic League as well, revokes the Edict of Restitution of 1629, which had sought to restore church lands, re-establishes the Peace of Augsburg provision of the ruler should decide the religion, though not for Calvinists. And as it were, and given that Wallenstein had already been murdered in 1634, it appears to be the case at that stage that the war in Germany has finished. And you could argue that is what leads the French to invade or to declare war in 1635. It's this sense of the situation is moving against them. And that certainly touches off the last long stage of the war, that from 35 to 48, in which there continue to be important German players, most obviously the Emperor, now Ferdinand III, Maximilian of Bavaria, the sort of ubiquitous figure in this thing, and Hessen Castle, which remains Calvinist territory, which remains at war against the Austrians, but that the key elements are France and Sweden, which are still in the war against the Austrians, although much of the French energy is devoted to fighting the Spaniards, just as most of the Dutch energy, because the Dutch war with Spain had revived in 1621. Equally, much of its energy is devoted to fighting the Spaniards in what is now Belgium.
Well, one country we haven't spoken about, of course, is England. Quite a number of English and Scottish soldiers fought in the 30 Years' War on a kind of privateer or mercenary basis, but England itself, amongst the European powers, didn't get directly involved. Was there a time when it might have got involved, or why did it not get involved?
Well, that's interesting. I mean, England, of course, was willing to fight on the continent. I mean, you know, there'd been an English army in the Dutch Revolt, 1585 to 1604. The English get involved in war again in the 1620s, separate wars against both Spain and France, launched initially the Spanish one by James I, and then under Charles I, you're fighting both Spain and France. And it's fair to say there are Protestant critics of both monarchs who would have liked a more hands-on intervention on the Protestant side in the 30 Years' War. But James I sees himself as a Christian peacemaker, doesn't want to do that. Charles I, who wishes to rule without parliament after 1629, scarcely wants the expense that will need him to turn back to parliament of intervening in the 30 Years' War. And on top of that, he has, I think it's fair to say, sympathies that are mixed. He particularly doesn't associate himself with Calvinists, but he also has crypto-Catholic circles at court, as indeed, to a lesser extent, did James I. So they don't wish to get involved in this conflict. Once you start moving towards crisis at the end of the 1630s, the two bishops' wars between Charles I and Scottish rebels, then the English state, British state, if you wish to use that term, because of course there had been a union of the crowns in 1603, is in no position to get involved in the 30 Years' War because it's involved in civil war right up to the early 1650s, when finally Cromwell suppresses opposition in both Scotland and Ireland. Now, you could take the view that in some aspects, the crises in the British Isles are part of a broader 30 Years' War because there are informal alignments. And you could take that view. But there is certainly no formal intervention by either England or Scotland. And I differentiate Scotland there because obviously Charles I's authority is overthrown in Scotland. There is no formal intervention by either of them.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Well, that's very clear. 30 years is a long time to be fighting a war. What sort of intensity was the war engaged in? Are we seeing periods of great intensity and then lengthy periods when not much has happened, or they're very little localized conflicts, skirmishes almost, and then there are big campaigns again? Or what is the tone and tenor in which the conflict is engaged in?
Well, there is both incessant what was called in the vocabulary of the period little war, small war, and there is significant campaigning, and the latter years of the war don't tend to attract an enormous amount of attention in the sort of noddy books of general, listeners may not have heard of Noddy. He's a children's character who had curious relations with a man with big ears. Now would be totally illegal. But anyway, in the sort of simple history books, the later years don't tend to be covered. But, these battles like Wittstock or Second Breitenfeld are important, Allerheim, are important battles. And there are major advances by, in particular, Swedish and French forces deep into what we would call Germany. And they inflict a considerable amount of damage. And indeed, as I've argued in some of my books, in practical terms, the devastation that occurs during the war encourages army structure, force structure to change. In place of the argument that you get from some people that, of course, gunpowder brings in the dominance of infantry and that cavalry is in some way anachronistic, what you've got are, in fact, smaller field forces, which include a large cavalry component. Because although cavalry costs more to hire, and many of these people were what we call mercenaries, and to pay, a cavalry trooper always had a higher pay than an infantryman. Nevertheless, they provide important opportunities for wide-ranging campaigns. And given the need to grab money and provisions to the outcome of campaigns, you need to actually range widely. So the Swedes, for example, who dominate the north, use it as a logistical base for operations into southern Germany. French interest in Swabia, in the what you might call Baden-Württemberg in the 1640s, reflects the same thing. And both the French and the Swedes move into Bavaria to loot it, although they know that it's beyond their capacity to overwinter there. So I think you've got the situation that it is actually a devastating war, but then it would be erroneous to assume that most of the wars in that period were not devastating.
Mm-hmm. I've read various conjectures about how much devastation was actually caused during the course of the war. What is your sense of I've read figures up to, half the dwellings of Germany were destroyed and so on. What is your sense of where the a more reliable basis for the statistics of casualties are, and can we disinter them from natural events like bad harvests, which were also causing lots of problems in the German lands at this time?
Well, not just in the German lands. I mean, this is a period known as, by the marvellous term of phase B of the early modern economy. And I mean, or you might choose to call it a sort of little ice age or whatever term you wish to use. Historians vie with each other for these imaginative terms. I think what one's got is a more general economic and population downturn. It affects the world as a whole in the 17th century. Temperatures appear to go down. The cold weather, of course, affects crops and diet. It causes hunger and poverty and exacerbates the impact of disease. So you get all sorts of consequences. I mean, you get population checked in areas that are not seeing sustained conflict. Interestingly enough, one of the aspects of it is fantasies about feasts play a major role in folk tales. And, you know, it's fair to say that although you can see some absolutely appalling situation, it's not equally the same across all of the German lands, no more than elsewhere where you see it. On the other hand, the spread of hostilities accentuated these demographic and economic pressures. So that produces both immediate devastation and longer term difficulties. And one of the things you could argue is that the relative demographic weight of France over the following 150 years was in part a consequence of the devastation on Germany of the 30 Years' War, just as in turn, the French Revolutionary Napoleonic War are to hit the French population. Now, clearly, as we know, other factors are responsible. So we know in the latter case, it's argued that contraceptive method changes in France also played a role. But I think it is fair to say that it is devastating, but any attempt to disaggregate war from other circumstances would be a quantitative fantasy.
Mm-hmm. Well, we're drawing towards the close. And so, the war itself does end. It ends in 1648. How does it end? And what are the consequences of the Peace of Westphalia, which brings it to a conclusion?
Well, I think that's a good question, but maybe we should handle that next week, because I tell you why. Because in a sense, the peace and the peace terms tell you more about how we are going to be developing into the late 17th century, in a sense, and to sort of end the 30 Years' War. It may be better to end the 30 Years' War with what would have been more profound, which is a sense of uncertainty about whether the war would end, uncertainty about whether there was some kind of secular apocalypse being visited upon human society, uncertainty about what would happen to individual families, communities, individuals. Maybe it's better to end at that point rather than to, as it were, smooth the war away by referring to the eventual peace terms.
Yes, well, let's do that. Let's just conclude with just the sense of as much the psychological state as the strategic and military one during the 1640s.
I think that's excellent. That will also encourage listeners to read up on the terms of the Peace of Westphalia before we meet again.
We shall do that. Professor Jeremy Black, author of A Brief History of Germany, thank you very much indeed.
Thank you. Let me add something that may interest listeners to lighten the tone somewhat. Munster, of course, a great, really important where negotiations took place. I visited a number of occasions, but I spent a period of time there in 1980 doing archival research in the summer. And I recall that after work was finished, I would relax by having a pint of the local beer in a cafe, and it was a local beer in which they put strawberries. It was a local sort of speciality. I've never seen strawberries drunk in beer before, but actually it was really rather pleasant, though on the whole, German beer is apt to be. Anyway, look forward to speaking again next week.
Thank you, Professor Black.
If you've enjoyed listening to this podcast, why not subscribe to have the magazine delivered to your door? Subscribe today with the current offer of 5 issues for £10 by heading to our website, www.thecritic.co.uk.